You are listening to another in the series of Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. You're going to hear about the Virginia Holocaust Museum at 20th and East Carey Street in Richmond. Dr. Charles W. Sidner, Jr. has been president of Emory and Henry College, president of Commonwealth Public Broadcasting, and he and I are both members of the Virginia Communications Hall of Fame, so let's see if we can communicate about the Virginia Holocaust Museum. Dr. Sidner is a student of the Holocaust. As an expert witness for the U.S. Department of Justice, he helped revoke the citizenship of 23 Nazi war criminals who had been living in the United States. He's the author of Soldiers of Destruction, the SS Death's Head Division, 1933-1945, and he's currently the executive director of the Virginia Holocaust Museum. Dr. Sidner, first tell us, how did you get interested in the Holocaust, you personally?
Well, I think it stems from the fact that I am in the first generation of Americans to grow up on television. And we lived at 2419 Maplewood Avenue in 1948-1949, and my father came home one afternoon with an Emerson television set, one of those things with the fake brass knobs and the little bitty round screen. And at that time, there was only one television station in Richmond, WTVR, the South's first television station. Soon there was one more. There was the NBC affiliate and then the ABC affiliate, which was in Petersburg and then moved to Richmond. But in about 1950-51, the network started producing historical documentary programming about the Second World War. And when I was 10, 11 years old, I saw those programs, and they used film from the Second World War, and the immediacy of that, the drama and all of it, and then for many reasons, it was just a compelling thing for me, not least because my father had served in the Navy in the Second World War in the Pacific, in the Marshalls, the Marianas, the Philippines, and then in the final campaign at Okinawa. And he was in his early 20s. At the age of 22, he was the captain of a small ship responsible for the lives of a crew of 16 men, a little thing called an LCT, a landing craft tank. And the war really sort of shaped his whole life. And so from that point on, I had an interest in the struggle that has never diminished. And for some reason, when I went to college, that evolved into an interest in the worst, the largest, and the most terrible crime of mass persecution and genocide in the history of humankind, the Nazis' extermination of 6 million European Jews. And in part, that came out of, again, visual images. There was a very famous photojournalist in the 1930s who worked for Life magazine, named Margaret Bourke White. And she was on commission from Life magazine with the U.S. Third Army in Europe in 1945 and was with a unit, a reconnaissance battalion, that liberated one of the first camps that American soldiers encountered, a place called Ohrdruf in Saxony. It's in central Germany. This is April the 12th, 1945, the same day Franklin Roosevelt died. Well, she made pictures of that concentration camp that were in issues of Life magazine that prompted congressional investigation and all sorts of activity. And then from there, as a college student, it progressed into serious reading. And then in graduate school at Vanderbilt, even more serious study, learning the German language to be able to do research in German archives. Then a year and a half in Germany as a graduate student at the University of Freiburg, and then a return to the United States and completed the PhD at Vanderbilt and started teaching at Ohio State. And then after 4 years, moved back to Virginia and taught for 8 years at Longwood, now Longwood University.
But you became an expert, so much so that the government relied upon your expertise.
Well, that's true, but it was it's a little less prosaic than it might seem. It was almost by default. The government had discovered in the late 70s that there were probably a substantial number of perpetrators, people who had engaged in war crimes, specifically in persecution of Jews and others that the Nazis considered enemies and inferiors, and that these people had gotten into the United States illegally by falsifying what they had been doing in the Second World War. Because immigration laws in this country in the 40s, 30s and 40s, specifically excluded from even getting a visa to travel to the United States anyone who had engaged in persecution of other human beings on the basis of race, religion, national origin, ethnicity, social status. Those laws were meant to exclude Nazis from getting into the United States. To make a long story short, the perpetrators who got in posed as victims rather than as perpetrators. And as the Justice Department was to find out in the beginning in about 1978 and continuing right through about 2005, there were several hundred of these people at least who got into the United States. There were 100 at least who were subjected to investigations by the Justice Department. And of that number, I'm not sure how many actually had cases brought against them. Now, they're not criminal cases. They're civil cases. We did not have any criminal jurisdiction that extended to Europe in the Second World War, except to our own armed forces. And those were, of course, military courts-martial. But we didn't have any criminal jurisdiction that extended to civilians or to combatants of the Axis countries, with the exception of the major war criminals who were tried at the end of the war. So the purpose of this was not to convict and imprison people who had murdered others. It was to get them out of the United States. And that required two steps. First of all, if they had obtained citizenship, you had to revoke that. And once the citizenship was revoked, then a separate proceeding to deport them from the United States. And that meant you had to find a country that was willing to take them back. So over a period of 24 years, I was involved in 23 cases, I believe. It actually testified in 20 trials as the government's expert. But at the time you were asking about being recruited, at the time this happened in 1980, there were only six of us in the United States who had actually studied deeply enough to earn PhD degrees in the field of Nazi German history. So we were almost by default the people that the government turned to. And there were three or four of us who ended up testifying in a whole bunch of trials. My friend Ron Smeltzer, who just retired at the University of Utah, I think George Browder testified in one or two trials. And then the Justice Department in the late 1990s, began to recruit some young German historians who were fluent in English to testify in these trials. But that's really how I sort of became directly involved in the history of this. And in the process, of course, the government's program to get these people out of the United States resulted in the amassing of a huge quantity of documents, because the trials had to have evidence, and the evidence was the records that the Germans themselves kept, SS concentration camp records, etc. And in the years that I worked for the government, they would make available documents for me to keep, and I accumulated and accumulated and accumulated. And in the end, I gave the museum, I think there are 23 cartons of records that came from these different trials. And three of the trials that I testified in involved the Auschwitz concentration camps.
Well, that background, that experience, makes you the perfect director at the moment for the Virginia Holocaust Museum. Tell us about the museum. How did it get started?
Museum is singularly compelling as an institution documenting the Holocaust, because it's built its foundation is the experience of a single Jewish family and their struggle to survive. This is the Ibsen family of Richmond. The late Israel Ibsen was the patriarch whose enterprise and courage and daring and ingenuity enabled the Ibsens to hide and successfully avoid being murdered by the Germans. His son Jay, who was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old at this period, a child survivor of the Holocaust, Jay Ibsen became the principal founder of the museum. And the museum was created it was officially dedicated in 1997, May of 1997. And at that time, I was one of the original trustees, along with Neil November and Norman Sporn and Paul Camp and Frank Seldes and I can't remember who else, but we were in the education building behind Temple Beth-El on Grove Avenue. And the museum was set up, and it was beginning to function, and it was going to be dedicated. And I didn't really have a grip on how significant that would be until the morning of the dedication services that were to be at Temple Beth-El. I arrived about 2 hours early. The synagogue was almost packed already. And on Grove Avenue, across the street from the museum, one behind the other were 7 satellite television trucks. And they were from as far away as Washington, D.C., Roanoke, Raleigh, Durham, and Norfolk, including satellite trucks from our affiliates here. I looked at that and thought, this is a pretty big deal. If television is here to cover this in that volume, this is a pretty big deal. And I think it was. We very quickly outgrew that facility. It was just, the public interest grew exponentially in the museum. And in 2001, as a result of a series of fortuitous circumstances, we were able to lease the old American Tobacco Company warehouse. I describe it as the great big ugly red brick building at 20th and Carey Street. Built at the end of the 19th century, it's a massive place, 120,000 square feet of floor space in 3 floors. We do not lack for room in a museum. It took 2 years to build it out into a museum. Jay and a group of volunteers built it out with comprehensive exhibits. In about 2007, we added a very substantial new exhibit, the Nuremberg courtroom. It is a replica of the courtroom in the Palace of Justice at Nuremberg, where the major Nazi war criminals were tried. It's the only thing like it in the world. That exhibit alone cost $500,000 to build. Then we began functioning there, and over the years we've grown into an institution that every year attracts over 20,000 school children from mainly Central Virginia, but from schools as far away as Norfolk and Harrisonburg and Greenville, Tennessee have come to the museum. We are now building a new permanent exhibit that will be housed on the second floor of the museum that will document the history of the 3 major concentration camps at Auschwitz. Auschwitz I, which was the original camp, the slave labor camp, the SS administrative center. Auschwitz II, which was the Birkenau extermination camp. That's the Auschwitz that most Americans are familiar with. The photograph of the ominous brick gate with the big opening and the railroad track going through the opening, that's Auschwitz II, Birkenau, the extermination camp. And then the massive camp the Germans built about 3 miles from Auschwitz II called Monowitz or Auschwitz III. The SS built that in partnership with IG Farben, the giant industrial complex. And that was built to produce synthetic rubber for the war effort, and synthetic gasoline. In point of fact, not a drop of gasoline and not one rubber tire was ever produced at that factory, but thousands of inmates lost their lives working as slave laborers building that project, as they did other projects at Auschwitz. Auschwitz was the epicenter of the Holocaust. In the period the Germans used, the SS used it to murder Jews, Gypsies, Catholics, Jehovah's Witnesses, Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, Romanians, Dutch, Belgians, French, Italians, Spaniards. There were even Americans gassed at Auschwitz. In the years Auschwitz was used, about 1,300,000 people were murdered there by the Germans. A million, at least 1 million of that number were Jews from all over Europe. And of that total number of 1.3 million, at least 200,000 were children under the age of 12. At the lowest point of their barbarism, the Nazis were the murderers of children. Not just at Auschwitz, but in the other camps. Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka, the places that consumed hundreds of thousands of lives. Auschwitz was the worst. Treblinka, the second worst. There were 900,000 Jews murdered there. Belzec, probably 360,000. Sobibor, 250 to 300,000. Kelmno, another couple of hundred thousand. You become almost jaded with numbers because the Germans, in Elie Wiesel's striking phrase, once they had murdered, the Germans sought to murder the murderers by covering up what they did. And so there are not exact records. I mean, we don't know the names of all the people who were murdered in different camps. I've met American families who lost grandfathers and aunts and uncles in the Holocaust, and the only thing they know is that in Poland they disappeared sometime between June of 42 and January of 43, or that they disappeared in the spring of 1943 in the Warsaw Ghetto and nothing was ever heard from them. They don't know where they were taken, when they were murdered, but I mean they can guess how. And if they were confined in the Warsaw Ghetto, they were almost certainly murdered at Treblinka. If they were in the Lodz Ghetto, or Jews deported from Western Europe, they were murdered at Auschwitz.
You're hearing from Dr. Charles W. Sidner, Jr., who is the director of the Virginia Holocaust Museum. Dr. Sidner, if people visit the Holocaust Museum today, what exhibits do they see?
You come to the museum. First of all, we charge no admission fee. Admission is free. Parking is free. We have two parking lots right across from the museum. Admission is free. Parking is free. And the exhibits are designed to take you first through the context and background of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism in Europe, the growth of anti-Semitism in Germany, Hitler's conquest of power, his accession to power, his transformation of National Socialism into a hatred-based political program, and then the persecution of minorities, beginning most importantly with the Jews. So there are exhibits that demonstrate how that happened in Germany, with documents, with artifacts, with exhibits. I think the most interesting artifact we have, in my mind, the most poignant, we have the uniform of a concentration camp inmate from the Sachsenhausen concentration camp north of Berlin. And as I tell people when I lead a tour, the SS guards, they recycle the uniforms but not the prisoners, because the uniform we have was probably worn over a period of 7 or 8 years by at least 3 or 4 different inmates. They would be exhausted by slave labor, shot by a guard. They would contract typhus and die. They would die of tuberculosis. And when they died, the uniform would be taken, fumigated, cleaned, put in a storage locker, and then reissued to another prisoner at some time. So the exhibits then lead to the Kovno Ghetto in Lithuania and to the Odyssey of the Ibsen family and how they survived. The big exhibit is a replica of the Kovno Ghetto itself. which takes the visitor then from the ghetto into the Lithuanian countryside and illustrates how the Ibsens survived in the farmland of Lithuania as a result of the help of a family, the Paskauskas family. And the Paskauskas stepson, Stanislavas Krivikius, who was a friend of Mr. Ibsen's, who helped hide the family literally underground in a bunker that they dug and lived in for about 4 months until the Russians overran Lithuania and chased the Germans out. And then they could come out and began the long odyssey that ended up in Richmond. Then from Kovno, you go through a big exhibit that honors Gentiles, non-Jews, who risked their lives to save the lives of Jews. A children's exhibit that is searing because it includes artwork drawn by children who lived in ghettos and camps, illustrating their perspective of things around them at the time. Then there are replicas of the undressing room at Auschwitz, adjacent to the gas chamber, the crematoria. And then a big exhibit that deals with the experience of American, British, and Russian soldiers in liberating camps. This is when the world first becomes aware of the Holocaust in the spring of 1945, when Allied soldiers are seeing for the first time, close up, in person, exactly what the Germans have been doing and how they've mistreated people. Places like Ordruff and Buchenwald, the American soldiers went in and found prisoners dying at the rate of 1,000 a day. At Bergen-Belsen, the British found 60,000 prisoners who had been herded into there from other camps with no provisions. And even after the British mobilized all of their medical facilities and got as many nurses and doctors into Bergen-Belsen as possible, inmates were still dying at the rate of 5,000 a day from the cumulative effects of persecution. So there's a big exhibit that deals with that. It shows what it was like to be the first outsiders to come face-to-face with the Holocaust. Then we go through the post-war experience of the Jewish victims of the Holocaust. The museum does not believe that the Holocaust ended until the State of Israel was formed in the spring of 1948, because those Jews who survived the Holocaust in Europe had no place to go. They couldn't go back home. Polish Jews who tried to go back home in June and July of 1945 went back to find that their homes were occupied by other people, and they were either kicked out of town or, in a couple of cases, they were actually murdered by their Polish neighbors. Jews who had survived the Holocaust and the best efforts of the Germans to kill them tried to go home after the war to end up being murdered by their neighbors. So the overwhelming tide of sentiment is, of course, Zionist. The belief, conviction that the only place in the world that Jews are going to be safe and have a future and survive will be in a country, a nation state that is a Jewish state. Hence the struggle to create out of the British mandate at Palestine what becomes the State of Israel. And then from there you go into the Nuremberg, the big Nuremberg courtroom, to look at how the Allies, having come face to face with the Holocaust now in 45-46, begin to understand the enormity of this crime and are determined to hold accountable those who've been responsible for it. The chief American prosecutor at Nuremberg was Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, whom FDR had personally selected to represent the United States. He was an incredibly able jurist, an eloquent man, and a very effective prosecutor. And in his opening statement, Jackson said words to the effect that the crimes we seek to illustrate and prosecute here were so malignant, so barbaric, so devastating, and so destructive that they cannot be ignored because civilization will not survive their being repeated. That could be the mission line for the mission of our museum, the mission of museums all over the country, community museums, several dozen at least in existence now, that do the same thing we do, interpret the Holocaust and incorporate into the exhibits and the library and the archives, incorporate into it how that community was touched by the Holocaust. In the case of Richmond, by the Ibsen family and by the other survivors of the Holocaust who settled here. Bud and Sonia Brodecki, Alex Keisch, Alan and Helena Zim, Helen Zim. I mean, there's a long list of survivors, many of whom are getting very elderly now and who are not going to be with us forever. And part of the urgency in the museum's mission is incorporating those stories into the exhibits and making sure that when those survivors pass from the scene, those stories continue to be told as part of the history of the museum, the Richmond Museum, and as part of the history of the Holocaust.
Among the things you've said, at least one thing will resonate with one of our listeners or another, because it's so important. What do you want to leave with our listeners about the Virginia Holocaust Museum, in summation?
I think what I would like to leave is this. The Holocaust still touches humankind in a way that nothing else in the 20th century did. It was the greatest and most terrible and deliberate and systematic destruction of human life in the history of humankind. It was the only occasion in human history in which a great modern industrial state mobilized the energies, resources, and capacities, managerial efficiency, industrial organization, technology, all transportation, modern transportation, all of that was mobilized and harnessed to the endeavor of killing human beings. The museum is an introduction to the Holocaust. Unlike the big museum in Washington, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which is almost overwhelming now, the Virginia Holocaust Museum has a way of enabling the student who's coming to learn first, maybe coming for the first time to learn about the Holocaust, to identify with it because there are specific individual human beings who are identified by name and place and time and circumstance and experience who are part of the story of the Holocaust. We had over 38,000 visitors last year. Of that number, the average time for touring and visiting the museum is 90 minutes. So some people stay an hour, some people stay an hour and a half. We've had people come from Canada who stayed for most of the day because they examined everything minutely. We have a library that now has over 4,000 volumes in it devoted just to the history of the Holocaust. Books and monographs, collections of documents, printed records, diaries, memoirs, all of that sort of stuff. I think because the trustees have insisted that there be no impediment to accessibility, we charge no admission, we charge no parking fees, you come and you walk in, you see what's there, and you can leave, and you can take material with you that will guide you further if you want to study this. I think everybody owes it to themselves and to their children at least one time to come to see this, see what it was about, learn how it became possible for a country, modern 20th century Germany, which in the early 20th century had led the world in science and technology, the number of Nobel Prize winners in literature, chemistry, physics, mathematics, political science, economics. How a country that had created that much turned around and became the most destructive organized society in the history of the planet. How did that happen? It's worth coming to see how it happened in order to leave behind for the future a record of how maybe to keep it from happening again.
The Virginia Holocaust Museum is at 20th and East Carey Street in Richmond, Virginia. Dr. Charles W. Sidner is the director of the Virginia Holocaust Museum. You're listening to Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.